United States of America, under the heading of the War on Terror. China, Iran, Russia, and others are embarking on a new security architecture for the world, replacing the Western-dominated global security structure rooted in racist Western colonialism and imperialism. New structures rooted in the BRICS Plus, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, and the non-aligned movement frameworks. Certain elites in Iran and China attempted rapprochement with the US and the West in the 1990s and the early 20th century, only to eventually realize that the West, and particularly the US, cannot shed its racist and imperialist nature and establish relations based on mutual benefit and respect. We are witnessing the beginning of a new global architecture based in Asia as the new and old center of human production and innovation. In addition to the incredibly abundant human and natural resources this continent has always had. Thank you for joining us on this episode. Until the next time on Insight.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
In Britain, Amnesty International has criticized the immigration plans announced by Tory leadership candidates Rishi Sunak and Liz Truss. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian's political correspondent, Aubrey Allegretti. The piece is titled, Rishi Sunak and Liz Truss Accused of Cruelty Over Rwanda-Style Deal Promises. In Britain, Tory leadership candidates Rishi Sunak and Liz Truss have been accused of cruelty and immorality for promising more Rwanda-style deals to remove asylum seekers from the United Kingdom as charities claimed the pair were pandering to party members' hardline views. Amnesty International read criticism of immigration plans announced over the weekend by the Conservative leadership candidates, saying the dreadful pledges would come at great human and financial cost. Other human rights groups, opposition parties, and the right-wing Adam Smith Institute think tank also condemned the proposals on grounds ranging from ethics to the crippling costs. Hostile briefings by the two camps intensified over the weekend as they prepared for a crunch television debate hosted by the BBC on Monday evening, with ballot papers set to drop through members' letters boxes in just over a week. The row about immigration threatened to overshadow their latest announcements, with Rishi Sunak pledging to take tougher action against China by banning its network of Confucius Institutes, while Liz Truss announced plans to cut red tape for free ports and create new investment zones with fewer planning restrictions. Both promised to push ahead with the plan to send hundreds of asylum seekers to Rwanda, which stalled last month after an intervention by the European Court of Human Rights. Rishi Sunak said he would do whatever it takes to get the Rwanda plan off the ground and operating at scale, and vowed to pursue more migration partnerships with other countries. In a 10-point plan on immigration, Rishi Sunak said he would cap the number of refugees the United Kingdom accepted each year, tighten the definition of who qualified to claim political asylum, and withhold aid money from countries that refuse to take back those whose claims were denied and criminals. In an article for the Sunday Express, caretaker Prime Minister Boris Johnson insisted he had delivered a key pledge to take back control of Britain's borders, but the former Chancellor contradicted that assessment. "We do not have control of our borders," Rishi Sunak said, adding that immigration should be legal, orderly and controlled, but at the moment it's none of those things. Rishi Sunak's plan to house migrants in cruise ships instead of hotels to save money was criticised by Liz Truss's campaign, which said the move would be likely to amount to arbitrary detention and a breach of domestic and international law. Pressed in a media interview on whether his proposals would be legal, Sunak did not give clear assurances, instead insisting no option should be off the table. The Foreign Secretary also said she was determined to see the Rwanda policy through to full implementation, as well as exploring other countries where we can work on similar partnerships. She pledged not to cower before the European Convention on Human Rights and to reform Britain's relationship with the Strasbourg-based Court of Human Rights so it works better. Although she is, unlike Sunak, a Brexit convert who voted Remain in the 2016 European Union referendum, the Foreign Secretary is seeking to present herself as a true heir to Boris Johnson, who will finish the job of overhauling immigration policy. Frontline border force capacity would be increased by 20% if she became Prime Minister, Liz Truss promised, allowing more channel patrols to take place to help curb the number of small boat crossings. Liz Truss and Rishi Sunak were accused by Amnesty International of making promises and policy based on nothing more than what is thought to appeal to some Conservative Party members. Steve Valdez-Simons, the charity's Refugee and Migrant Rights Programme Director, said it was the same as it had been for the last 3 years. Steve Valdez-Simons added, "It is why our asylum system has collapsed into chaos and backlogs, all at great human and financial cost." He said, "It is dreadful that those who aspire to lead are showing no capacity for leadership, which requires focus on what is possible, necessary, and lawful. Instead, they're setting out on the same dismal course of blaming people fleeing persecution, lawyers, and courts of law for all the ills that our politicians continue to heap upon everyone, rather than taking responsibility for making our asylum system work fairly and efficiently. Zira Hassan, Advocacy Director at the Joint Council for the Welfare of Immigrants, also said both Rishi Sunak and Liz Truss were showing their fierce commitment to cruelty and immorality by trying to abdicate all responsibility for people forced to move to the United Kingdom. Zira Hassan continued by saying they want to expand the hostile environment and ramp up the brutalization of refugees for political point scoring. Their plans will only destroy more lives and tear more families apart. Concerns were also raised over the value for money feasibility of the Rwanda plans, which have cost taxpayers £120 million in exchange for up to 200 asylum seekers being relocated. Emily Fielder, head of communications for the Adam Smith Institute, said it was ineffectual because, in reality, barely any flights to Rwanda will take off, leaving an asylum system continuing to struggle with a huge backlog and crippling costs. Emily Fielder added, rather than governing by press release, the Conservative Party should look towards engaging more constructively with our European partners, introducing safe routes for those fleeing persecution and implementing vital reforms to clear the backlog of legacy of asylum cases. Yvette Cooper, the Shadow Home Secretary, said it was dismal to see Rishi Sunak and Liz Truss competing to extend an unworkable, unethical, unaffordable, high-fraud risk Rwanda scheme that she said would only make trafficking worse. The Liberal Democrats said both leadership candidates wanted to throw away more good money after bad and should never be trusted again with taxpayers' money, let alone trusted to treat asylum seekers with decency and respect.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
U.S. President Joe Biden just visited the West Asia to promote Washington's agenda in that region. Apart from encouraging Washington's Arab allies to pump more oil into the market to bring down rising energy prices, Biden, on behalf of the Israeli regime, was trying to form a coalition against Iran. But the much-publicized event failed to garner support from the United States' Arab allies. Now, Iran's foreign ministry spokesman, Nasser Kanani, says the latest plot in the West Asia region failed because the regional countries do not trust Washington. Kanani also said Iran considers the security of its neighbors as its own security.
The Saudis are recognizing the U.S. is in decline, and Joe Biden is the symbol of America's decline, mentally, politically, socially, religiously. And they have embarked on a different geopolitical, economic, military agenda, and that is to unite with the BRICS nations and seek their political destiny elsewhere than within the United States. So I think Joe Biden's trip was an absolute failure. It didn't accomplish anything, and we knew it wouldn't accomplish anything.
Just the day before the summit between Biden and the Persian Gulf Cooperation Council countries, plus Egypt, Jordan and Iraq, Mustafa al-Kadhimi, the Prime Minister of Iraq, said Baghdad will not be part of any camp or military alliance. He also said, quote, Iraq will not be a base for threatening any neighboring countries. The UAE, which is a close ally of both Saudi Arabia and the US, also dismissed the idea of forming an anti-Iran NATO-like military alliance. We are open to cooperation, but not cooperation targeting any other country in the region, and I specifically mention Iran. Such comments show that Biden, who has practically followed the anti-Iran policies of his predecessor Donald Trump, failed to achieve his stated objective of forming a military alliance against Tehran.
So this entire trip of Joe Biden's was a futile effort, wasted effort, and I think it only depreciated America in the eyes of other nations. And for that reason, other nations are seeking political alliances elsewhere in other global institutions, such as the BRICS nations and the Chinese Belt and Road Initiative and other things.
Iran's foreign ministry spokesman also dismissed the recent Israeli threats against the Islamic Republic as psychological warfare. Nasser Kanani says the Tel Aviv regime has neither the courage nor the capability to confront Iran militarily. He also vowed that Tehran would give a decisive and destructive response to any Israeli aggression. Iran's response to any idiocy committed by the Zionist regime would be destructive.
Not only is the United States incapable of any military conflict, but Israel is also incapable of any military conflict. And Israel is incapacitated, yet they are putting on an aura of functionality, an aura of threats. But at the heart, Israel has no capacity to wage a conflict against Iran. This is all bluff, and this trip confirms it.
Kanani's comments come in response to threats made by Israeli Army Chief Aviv Kohavi. The Israeli general has said, quote, it's Israel's moral obligation to prepare a military response against Iran's nuclear program. He also added that such preparations for such a strike are at the center of the military's program. Kohavi's warmongering rhetoric against the Islamic Republic comes despite Iran's insistence that it's not seeking to develop nuclear weapons. The leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Khamenei, has issued a religious decree against weapons of mass destruction. And just recently, Kamal Kharazi, the head of Iran's Strategic Council on Foreign Relations, rejected allegations that Iran seeks nuclear weapons. He said Iran has the technical capability to go beyond the current 60% uranium enrichment level, but it will not go that path. It's an open secret that Israel is the sole possessor of nuclear weapons in the region and has hundreds of warheads. The regime's officials have constantly threatened Iran with strikes on its nuclear facilities. The regime is responsible for the murder of a number of Iran's nuclear scientists. It has also carried out sabotage attacks against Iran's nuclear facilities. And its latest threats against Iran are just meant to shore up its crumbling hegemonic position.
As the crisis in Ukraine lingers on, the United States and its allies appear to run out of measures to halt Russia. They have imposed various sanctions on Moscow. Russia's energy, banking, and financial sectors have been targeted by the West. But the punitive measures do not appear to have the intended results. Now, the United States is proposing the idea of putting a price cap on Russia's oil.
Yeah, I mean, this is more suicidal stuff from the West. I mean, one thing which this Western-centric, this US-centric, European-centric view of themselves as being indispensable parts of the world, I think is the main problem here, because they view themselves as the center of the universe, so to speak, in everything, in politics, economics, etc. However, they fail to understand that the world is rapidly changing.
The West is trying to limit the price of Russia's oil in order to deprive the country from the money it needs to run the war. The goal is said to be to set the price at a level that covers the marginal cost of production so that Russia would be encouraged to keep producing oil. The idea, which was first proposed by Washington, was agreed upon at the G7 summit back in June. Western countries plan to allow only those raw material and oil products whose value does not exceed the price cap. In reaction to the proposed idea, Russia has threatened that it would not export oil to the world market if a price cap is imposed. If these prices, which they are talking about, are lower than the costs for oil production, naturally, Russia will not ensure the supply of this oil to the world market, which means that we simply will not work at a negative profit. It's not yet clear whether Western nations have the capability to implement such a plan, but there are already warnings that this scheme may actually backfire. Russia's president says the price cap would further propel global oil prices, and Security Council Deputy Chairman Dmitry Medvedev has warned that oil would be traded between $300 to $400 per barrel if the West goes through with the plan.
The European markets and the US markets are not the prime markets for Russian energy supplies. The prime markets are now Asia, and so they're out of step with what is happening in the world. And what this will do will exacerbate, as you noted, an already rather tenuous energy crisis, which is caused by, on the one hand, shortages of energy supplies, and on the other hand, costs of energy supplies. Because to cap it, who's going to sell it to the West under the production cost? No one, especially when the West treats them the way that they are treating them. So, I mean, it's going to be another shot in the foot for the US and its vassal and client states.
Some analysts are predicting that the scenario would be catastrophic for the US and the other group of seven countries. Market watchers have predicted that China and India, two key players in the Asia region, may not cooperate with the price cap. Western sanctions on Russia have already failed to deprive the country from its revenues. They have actually increased the money Moscow makes from its energy exports. Oil prices climbed to 14-year highs shortly after the war began on February 24. They remain above $100 per barrel. According to other analysts, history shows that such attempts end in failure. The US tried to fix prices for oil in the 1970s, and the UK tried to set the forex prices in the 80s. All those attempts failed, and the prices boomed after those debacles.
The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution has advised the visiting Turkish president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, against any aggression in northern Syria. Ayatollah Khamenei told Erdogan that any military action in northern Syria will definitely harm Turkey, Syria and the entire region and will instead benefit terrorists. Ayatollah Khamenei described as very important the issue of Syria's territorial integrity and said a military incursion of Syria will only benefit terrorists. Ayatollah Khamenei further added that Iran considers security in Turkey and its border areas as its own. He called on Turkey to pursue a similar approach vis-a-vis its neighbor, Syria. For his part, President Erdogan accused the United States of feeding terrorist organizations in Syria. He further said Russia and Iran should support Turkish operations in Syria. Erdogan said Ankara believes Tehran and Moscow have the same opinion on Kurdish YPG militants operating in northern Syria.
Strategically, both Iran and Russia have taken the correct approach. They are focusing on the removal of the US threat first and I think they believe they can deal with Mr. Erdogan after that, because after all, his key pretext for intervening in Syria and trying to annex part of Syria is the threat from Kurdish separatists who are facing his troops south of the border there. At the moment, there's a collaboration with the Syrian army and the Kurdish separatists in some areas of the north of Syria.
In recent months, Turkey has been mauling a military operation in northern Syria against Kurdish militants that Ankara considers as terrorists. The militants are located in the cities of Tal Rifat and Manbij.
Effectively, there is some common ground there between Iran and Turkey in relation to the Kurdish proxies, which are being trained by Israel and by the US in the north of Iraq now. So the situation is complicated, but I think that, as I said, the priority of getting rid of the US occupation has to be recognised there, even though there are many people who are very concerned about the role Mr. Erdogan's been playing for many years now.
The meeting was followed by Syrian Foreign Minister Faisal Miqdad's visit to Tehran. Miqdad said Damascus will not tolerate the violation of its territorial integrity. Iran, Russia and Turkey have held a trilateral summit on the Syrian peace process. The summit was the seventh meeting of the Astana process. It was held on Tuesday in Tehran and attended by Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi, Russian President Vladimir Putin and Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan.
We all emphasize that we should combat terrorism, and there is the need to do so, and there is also a need for cooperation among all states. Today, terrorist currents have jeopardized the security of the region.
Raisi further slammed the U.S.'s unilateral sanctions on Syria. The sanctions have put additional pressure on the Syrian people and deprived them of the possibility of a normal life.
The primary focus, the priority has to be to get the U.S. out of Syria and Iraq, by the way, because, of course, the use of terrorist groups is something that the U.S. is the mastermind of, basically, and it's been behind ISIS and al-Qaeda, all of those associated groups using the Saudis and so on.
And the biggest problem today, it was mentioned, the common will to fight international terrorism there, and also the foreign forces, meaning here the American forces and the others, that they should leave the Syrian territory.
The U.S. invaded Syria in 2014 after supporting terrorists in the country. Washington began stealing and smuggling the Syrian crude from the oil-rich eastern province of Deir al-Zor and elsewhere under former American President Donald Trump.
As the underpinnings of many Western countries are being called into question, China is holding out both its political and economic model as a thriving alternative. Over the past four decades, Beijing has increasingly asserted its power on the global stage and is now on course to become the world's biggest economy even sooner than predicted pre-pandemic. But now, as the world undergoes changes unseen in decades, China alongside Russia seem to be embroiled in a battle with the West, both in terms of economies and military might, a battle which the West seems to be on the losing side. Amid simmering tensions between the two sides, the former British Prime Minister says the Ukraine war is an indication of the West's diminishing dominance. Tony Blair stated that the West dominance is coming to an end as China rises to superpower status in partnership with Russia at one of the most significant inflection points in centuries.
The collective West needs to take into account now is that they are not alone. They need to stop their imperialist way of approaching how they see the world. They tend to say, well, the global worlds, but when they say the global world, they only mean maybe 15% of the population. But the problem now is that they don't have the weight they used to have, and they need to take into account that you have an emerging world, and we are living the last days of the imperialistic West.
from trade wars against China to sanctions on many countries, including Russia, Iran, and Venezuela, the West has in the past decade went on a rampage against any nation not willing to play by its rules. But now, the West's risky games have backfired, and signs of distress are multiplying, with falling currency valuation, social crisis, inflation, poverty, and much more. Those coercive measures also, however, push targeted nations closer to each other, setting the foundations of a multilateral world. In the 1960s, while the US was putting a man on the moon, China was struggling to feed its 1 billion people during the decade-long Cultural Revolution. The US was enjoying a favorable economic environment, and China, on the other hand, was faced with a completely stagnant and ruined economy coupled with widespread famine. But nearly two decades later, in light of vast economic reforms, China opened up to private businesses and foreign investment. Dominant state-owned bank turned savings into financing tools for roads, rail links, and ports, all this while foreign firms were forced to set up alongside a local partner, encouraging the transfer of technology. As a result, the economy grew 90-fold over the next four decades. But history clearly shows that plagues and wars are things that either cause the downfalls of particular order or cause a rethink. So when these disasters arise, a void is created waiting to be filled by a superior nation or nations.
I think it's not about, you know, either one pole or the other. You know, we might enter into a bipolar world or ideally a multipolar world. It doesn't mean that it's going to be a complete downfall. You know, the world needs the West. It's not about either or. It is about how we can live together. But if the West keeps on going into this direction, it might be a downfall, especially when you look at the economy. How are they going to manage when the dollar is not going to be the global currency? Now the dollar being a global currency makes the U.S., gives the U.S. this power to print endless paper, which is backed by nothing. So that, if we talk about downfall, well, we might have an economic downfall, because the day that the dollar is no more the global currency, hegemonic currency, then you then will experience hyperinflation, and it could be extremely dramatic.
In the past couple of years, not only China, but several sovereign nations, including Russia and Iran, demonstrated the power which can be gained through sovereignty. And countries relying on the West, on the other hand, presented an example of the problems that could arise upon relying on others. From the formation of new allegiances such as the BRICS or the G20 to a shift away from a unipolar world and dependency on the US, all signs indicate a shift in global order towards a multilateral world.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Salam and welcome to the program. As a reminder, it was said that Imam Khomeini was sent to exile to Turkey and that his wife and family didn't hear from him for 5 months. It was also said that the Imam was in Turkey for nearly 1 year, after which he was transferred to the holy city of Najaf in Iraq. The measure was taken by the regime in a bid to eclipse Imam Khomeini's scientific and political personality influence before the great ulema in Iraq. Stay tuned for the rest of the story. Nearly 1 month after Imam Khomeini's compulsory exit from Turkey for Iraq, his wife, Lady Khadija Saqafi, and some of his family members were allowed to travel to Najaf. They left Qom for Najaf under a secret SAVAK agent's supervision. Ms. Saqafi says, "To go to Najaf, it was necessary to have SAVAK's agreement. They permitted to travel to Iraq, but without any man, woman, or child, except ourselves. We told them that we needed a man to carry the luggage. They let us take our worker, Mashadi Hassan, but didn't let Ahmad accompany us. We left for Iraq with an agent of SAVAK in the clothes of a clergyman. My son Ahmad was left alone in Iran. The trip to Iraq took 24 hours, but the travelers stayed at the customs custody due to lacking the health paper." The Imam's wife continues, "The next morning, we reached the Iraqi customs. We had forgotten to take health papers, so we were quarantined at the dirty customs for 1 week. The driver was a religious person. As he recognized us, he said, 'Don't be upset. I will go to Najaf from Kazemain and tell them to transfer your luggage to a warehouse in Kazemain.' He did the same. In the afternoon, we were vaccinated and we had only one pot from the luggage. We were 17 people and they settled us in a roughly large room with 10 beds. Imam Khomeini's wife continues the story. "Finally, 1 week was over and Mr. Shabestari came to us with two cars and we were taken directly to Najaf. It was dark when we arrived in Najaf. We entered a house which we had not seen the like before. After passing through a narrow and gloomy corridor, we were shown steps which were meandering. Either there was no light in the course or it was so dimly lit that we couldn't see under our feet and the children fell several times. Then we got into a small room where the Imam was sitting in one corner. The visit of Imam Khomeini with his family was very emotional and warm." Lady Saqafi relates the visit. "The daughters rushed with tears and enthusiasm to kiss the Imam. I too started greeting. He said, 'How are you?' I said, 'Fine.' His behavior was in a way as if he had seen everyone the day before. He was greeting so calmly. I asked, 'Where is Mustafa?' He said, 'He has gone to the shrine.' He came back a few minutes later. I hugged him and burst into cry. I hadn't wept that way for a while. My weeping was unusual. My whole body was shivering. Everybody was surprised as they knew how patient I was." Ms. Saqafi further explains the house in Najaf. "The kitchen was a crypt with no water, sewage system, and even a place to put the dishes. When we wanted to serve the food, we would take the pot out of the kitchen, and if I wanted to monitor the food, our worker would come out as there was not enough room. We spent 13 years and a half in this way. Our house had only a threadbare rug and two rotten gilims. Later, Mustafa satisfied his father to buy a 9-meter rug, and one of the friends gave us a refrigerator as a present. Imam Khomeini's wife, Miss Khadija Saghafi, relates her stay in Najaf. I had no telephone in Najaf. At times that I was missing my sisters, brothers, and parents. While telephone was the easiest way for contact, the Imam believed that we should never use religious money for personal and private conversation. Thus, he was not willing to bring a telephone set for the interior. Thus, I would not insist on having a direct call line, although I liked to contact with my relatives. I would write my words on a paper, and they would answer a few days later. Dear listeners, Imam Khomeini was very careful and exacting on spending religious money, which people would send him, a great source of emulation. Once, he told his son Ahmad, "God willing, you will be successful in acquisition of religious sciences and ethical purification. Firstly, do not send cheese anymore. It is not good for neither of us, and I am prevented to eat it. Secondly, do not write anything about telephone so that I would pay for it. I will not have a telephone line, and you don't have anything except the money of the poor. It is good to practice observing of religious money and refraining from excessiveness. Almighty God will be satisfied with you." When Imam Khomeini's daughters returned to Iran, the conditions were tougher for his wife. So she says, "The daughters' 3 months' stay was over. They returned to Iran with my mother and left us alone in a lonely city. There was no friend. No one is speaking the same language, no companion. We were in a small room away from all dear ones, especially Ahmad, who was 18, and I didn't know what would happen to him. Thank God, with his intellect and prudence, I knew that he would handle his personal affairs and those of the Imam's office." Ms. Saghafi continues, "Little by little, we made friends in Najaf. Even if there was no struggle in the houses of the ulema in Najaf, they were the people of knowledge. Imam's elder son, Haj Agha Mustafa, had learned from him to lead a simple life. His mother writes on his way of living, "Mustafa was in our house for 2 months till he found a house. They had no home appliances, and we gave them some of our own. They had no bed for a while, and they used to sleep on the roof, which was so hot. He had no refrigerator. When he was said, 'Think for your children. What is their guilt?' he would answer, 'God doesn't like me to have refrigerator while my old father lives without it.'"
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The following is the text of the speech delivered on June the 28th, 2022, by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the head of the judiciary branch and a number of the top officials and employees of the judiciary. The divine traditions are laws. How do laws work? The law is about a certain situation, and it has a certain degree and result. If you put yourself in that situation, the result will definitely come. If you help the cause of Allah, He will guide you. The Quran 47:7. Helping the cause of God is the situation in this verse. If you help God, the result and decree is His helping you. If you put yourself in this situation, the result will surely come. There is no doubt about this. There is no doubt about this. These are divine promises. The Quran contains God's explicit command to us. There is not even a single bit of exaggeration, contradiction, or the like in them, God forbid. However, the condition is that you must put yourself in that situation. If you do, that result will be given to you.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The Islamic Republic moved forward in this way at that time. We were victorious whenever we moved in this way. That is, whenever we put ourselves in a situation to which one of the divine traditions applied, the Almighty God gave the result. And that if they should keep to the right way, we would certainly give to them a drink of abundant water. The Holy Quran 72:16. God says that if you stand firmly, He will quench your thirst and satisfy your need. We stood firmly. God satisfied our needs. The opposite is also true. The divine traditions are of different kinds and types. In one place He says, if you are grateful, He will certainly give you more. In another He says, and if you are ungrateful, My chastisement is truly severe. The Holy Quran, Surah 14, verse 7. This is a tradition too. Being ungrateful means being ungrateful for God's blessings. If you are ungrateful for the blessings, you do not use the blessings, you misuse them, you abuse them. If you do these things, My chastisement is truly severe. That is one of the divine traditions too. If we put ourselves in that situation, being ungrateful, that result will come upon us.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. Guide me from all the ways
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio, with you every single moment.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Pureza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahan Abbott, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Evidence continues to mount that Europe's sanctions campaign against Russia is exacerbating the euro currency's persistent and perhaps structural economic troubles. France's finance minister just released a depressing outlook. This year's economic growth will be cut almost in half and remain between just 1.4 and 1.8% until at least 2028. The Eurozone's second largest economy now looks too weak to drive what many have long called the world's most unstable macroeconomic bloc. From 2008 to 2017, the Eurozone's average annual economic growth was just 0.6%. From 2018 through 2021, the growth rate was even worse, just 0.5%, putting the Eurozone on track for a second consecutive lost decade. Despite the clear failure of austerity policies in producing growth, President Emmanuel Macron will continue with far-right economics in his second term. His finance minister boasted of plans to cut much-needed public spending to a 20-year low, citing a desire to submit to Brussels' entirely arbitrary 3% rule on public deficits.
We're talking about a systemic crisis in Europe, and one which existed before the crisis caused by the pandemic, as well as the crisis caused by the need to find alternative energy sources other than Russia. What it all adds up to is that a state of crisis continuing still.
This week, the new and deeply fractured National Assembly passed the Emergency Purchasing Power Bill, aimed at countering still-rising, once-in-a-generation inflation. At just 20 billion euros, it has been widely criticized as an ineffective and even superficial measure.
For many people, this bill is insufficient in comparison with the scope of the crisis. The same criticism has been made of a government fuel rebate of 18 cents, which began in April. However, it is 20 billion euros which will help the poorest level of society and students deal with the effects of high inflation.
France's government claims that upcoming austerity rollbacks planned for the pension and unemployment system will actually produce broad economic growth this time. The European Central Bank is raising interest rates, even though the Eurozone is already on the brink of recession. Sanctions and not diplomacy continues to be the destabilizing Western choice regarding Ukraine. The long-term economic outlook for France and the Eurozone appears bleak to many. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Thousands of Palestinians took part in funeral processions of Mohammed Azizi, 25, and Abdurrahman Subh, 28, who were killed early Sunday during an Israeli military raid in the occupied West Bank city of Nablus and its old town. The Fatah Armed Wing Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade says the two Palestinians were its members, while the Israeli military says the operation in Nablus was launched to apprehend armed suspects. Following the raid, a general strike called across Nablus to mourn the death of the two Palestinians.
The operation this time was more violent than the previous ones. Clashes were heavy as Israeli soldiers raided the neighborhood from all sides. Live ammunitions and rockets were fired towards the houses. I believe such ammunitions are only used in wars between countries.
Israeli forces raided Al-Yasamin neighborhood and surrounded a house, which the regime said Palestinian fighters had barricaded themselves in. Eyewitnesses described the raid as a full-blown military invasion, while the Palestinian Red Crescent reported 19 injuries, including 10 people hit by live fire. The Palestinian leadership has condemned the operation, with a spokesman of the Palestinian president saying the Israeli crime will not defeat the Palestinians and will not break their will.
It's a barbaric act. It's another crime committed by the Israeli forces. They fired rockets at a house and they knew people were inside it. Two young men were killed and many others were wounded. It's obvious that the entire region will remain in a circle of violence until the occupation ends.
At least 52 Palestinians have been killed since late March, as Israel has intensified its aggression after a wave of deadly anti-Israel operations that led to the killing of Israeli soldiers. The Israeli military has never stopped its raids in the occupied West Bank. Such operations have often led to the death and injury of Palestinians, like what happened in Nablus. Regardless of how many people are killed or injured in the raids, Palestinians say resistance is their only option until they free the occupied territories. Mona Qandil, Occupied Ramallah.
We all remember her from pictures. At the time that her father was assassinated, Armita Razai Nejad was only 5. Her mother, Shohra Pirani, was also wounded in the attack. Today, her story has found its way on the silver screen, revealing new dimensions of how Dariush Razai Nejad was martyred. What made the ordeal even tougher was the fact that Dariush was shot right in front of his wife and his 5-year-old daughter. The international community, human rights advocates, and even the UN remained silent. This prompted Shohra Pirani to write a letter to then-U.S. Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, denouncing in the strongest terms the assassination of researchers and scientists. Her move inspired a group of filmmakers to make a movie based on the story.
About 5 or 6 years ago, we decided to make this movie. I believe that as filmmakers, we had a responsibility to do so.
This is a very important part of our contemporary history. It's a story that just had to be told. It should have been done sooner.
I was preoccupied by this incident for years. How can you kill someone right in front of his 5-year-old kid? I did some research, and as soon as the opportunity came up, we decided to make the movie.
Hanas, which literally means breath, is a biopic that dramatizes the story of Dariush Razai Nejad, a nuclear scientist that was assassinated in 2011.
This movie is actually a document that shows how Iran has been a victim of terror attacks. There aren't many countries in which such brutal terror attacks have happened. The assassination of a scientist and researcher while his family is watching.
This was a very educational movie showing us the animosity of Israel and the United States.
I found it to be an educational movie, both important and interesting.
I learned a lot. It was very interesting.
The feminine touch has turned this biopic into a must-see, and now, in an open letter, Armita has called on all foreign ambassadors in Iran to watch the movie, too.
In the words of Armita, the daughter of the martyred scientist Dariush Razai Nejad, Iranian or non-Iranian, everyone should watch this movie just to catch a glimpse of the atrocities and human rights violations that are committed against the Iranian people, while the international community remains silent. Kisumi Shah Ahmadi, Tehran.
South Korean peace activists gathered at Imjingak, a peace park near the border with North Korea, to call for an official declaration to end the 1950-53 Korean War. They also want the agreements made during previous inter-Korean summits to be upheld.
Let's join together, 80 million people for peace. Let's get together, people for peace around the world. Let's start today the great journey of marking the 70th anniversary of the armistice. Next year, the year of the end of the war and the first year of the peace agreement.
Peace activists traveled in groups from across South Korea to join the event. Former President Moon Jae-in had sought engagement with North Korea, but his push for an inter-Korean peace failed to materialize. Participants here want results.
We gathered here because